Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. It is Mr. Gadgets once again driving through the what passes for rush hour traffic in Kansas City, and going to continue on my journey through technological history here of the microcomputer and trudging on towards when I started using Linux. Believe me or not, believe it or not, we're going to get there eventually. So I was working at the software company in Kansas City. They got bought out by Informix Corporation, and that gave me lots of good access to, like, Sun machines and Solaris and Unix and all kinds of fun stuff there. But I left them to work for another company here that had the headquarters here in Kansas City, because it's not very nice being, you know, it's supposed to be a merger, but it really got bought out by the California company, and we got some perks about that, but, you know, not working at headquarters is not necessarily a good thing. And so I started then working for a local company here in Kansas City area that works in financial services. That took me away from the access to the command line and being able to do, you know, shell scripting and all that kind of stuff. And actually veered me off into OS2. Think about it. This is the early 90s, so what would you base your enterprise-wide high availability solution to process financial requests with, say, 1,000 seats with people? Would you base that on Windows 3.1, or would you base it on OS 2? So I veered off into that direction and started learning that operating system, and, you know, there were a lot of positive things about OS 2. And I still, to this day, kind of agree with some of the guys that I work with that I think IBM should actually open source OS 2 to get another interesting thing into the mix. It could be modernized into a more modern operating system with all of the bells, whistles, USB drivers, and other kinds of things that we expect now, Wi-Fi drivers, those kinds of things. That company actually bought PS2 machines, real IBM PS2s. We used NCR machines for a while there. Once again, National Cash Register, NCR, made computers. They don't anymore, but back in this time frame, they made computers. In fact, they were the only other people who used microchannel bus, and we used microchannel bus, which was a vast improvement. You might laugh now because it didn't have wide adoption, but is a vast improvement over the ISA kinds of bus machines that were of the time, where you had to you know, use little dip switches to set, you know, addresses for things like that. Microchannel was much more of a plug and play. It's just that IBM had a patent on that and thought people should pay them a license fee to put it in their machines. And definitely the only people who actually used microchannel in their business machines of the time was NCR. The reason why? Well, NCR had invented SCSI, the small computer serial interface. So the SCSI interface patent was traded to IBM for the microchannel bus patent. And there's, you know, SCSI found wider adoption, of course, and microchannel went by the wayside. I did have to have my internet connection. And so I went through a whole series of internet providers, probably one every 6 months. I get one, just get it running pretty well, and then they would be bought out by somebody else. At this time also, my wife is a teacher, and we had a lot of Macintoshes. This is not OS 10. This is back in the old OS 6, OS 7 days. And things like that, and I was figuring out how to get my modem to dial in to these providers for my internet connection. Of course, it was a time of modems, right, to go in, no high speed, to the houses very commonly back then. And I was figuring out how to do that. Most of the time, they would just have a setup disk, but that didn't do me any good. I would call up the provider and just say, okay, what do I need to put in at such and such a point? If you just tell me, you know, what this is, I can set it up on my Mac system. Slight veering off here. This is actually, back when I was setting up Macs and setting up Ethernet back in the 80s, it was before DNS got invented, as far as I know, but or at least before it was widely in use. So static IPs were the rule of the day. And, you know, you assign those IP addresses to every single person out there. And doesn't seem strange to me, because that was the way you did it. You managed your network, right? Well, there was this crazy thing that Macintoshes would do. This is, once again, back in the earlier pre-OS X Unix-y kinds of days. You could tell it a range of IP addresses that you wanted the machine to have. And then it would go out there and try an address in that range. And if it didn't get back a conflict that said somebody already had that IP address, it would just assign that to itself. So essentially, it was a predecessor to DNS, except it was the machine saying, here's the range of things I'm going to try to assign to myself, and it was catch-as-catch-can. It's just crazy, the creativity that people had before they came up with, why don't we have a server to hold these things out? I had to do a lot of this, of course, since I was using Macintoshes by hand, and I actually had one guy who called me back and said, you know about Macintoshes, right? Would you, like, help this other guy who has a Macintosh? And I don't have no idea what to tell him to do to be able to log in. I actually ended up trading for some months of service and answered support questions for him from Macintosh. I'd call people up and get them set up on their system. But I kept on going through them. And it was – some of them actually gave me shell accounts, and I could still do a little shell scripting and get straight to the raw command line on those machines. Somewhere in this time frame, I discovered two things. Number one, I discovered microcenters. In fact, I know exactly when I discovered microcenter the first time. It was in Houston, Texas. I went to Houston, Texas 6 times during the summer between May and September of 1998. And I know that for a fact because that was the first time I came across a microcenter. I looked out my hotel window, and there it was across the highway from the Marriott hotel I was staying in. And I know it was 98 because I stayed up, I took a little nap, and got up at midnight and went over to buy my copy of Windows 98 at that store. They opened up at midnight, you know, back when releases of Windows were a big deal. And they actually came out on the year that was in their name. So that's just mean, isn't it? All right, so microcenter, and it was at a microcenter. I don't remember whether it was the one there in Houston. Like I said, 6 times to Houston between May and September. Boy, that's really the prime time you want to go to Houston, right? All for one client, except for one trip to another client that we have. We have basically 3 clients there in Houston. 4 now. We had 3 at the time. And either at that Houston store or at the Boston store, which is at 333 Memorial Drive up in Cambridge, I know that for a fact because that was my address according to Microcenter for years. And finally, when they put a Microcenter here in the Kansas City area, they had 2 addresses for me. One was in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and one was my address here in Kansas City. It may have been at that Boston Microcenter store. I have set myself on a couple of, you know, goals that are achievable in life. I've gone to every Fry store, and except for the new ones that they open, but I've gone to every existing Fry store, as far as I know, in California, and I'm working on all the other Fry stores in every other state. I've hit all 3 of them in the Houston area. And in fact, I went to one of them like the oh gosh, it was like within a week of it opening. down there south of Houston, close to the Space Center. It, of course, has a space, you know, theme. And I was at this Micro Center there, back to Micro Center, and I came across this Corel, I think it was, version of Linux, this Unix-like operating system. And this was a fascinating kind of thing to me. Now, this is still the time of, you know, the dial-up, right? So you pretty much had to get CDs. It wasn't even common to have DVDs at this time. But you pretty much had to get CDs to do an install because you weren't going to be downloading a whole bunch of stuff very fast over your internet connection. And so packaged CDs were very, very common at the time. Now, I don't know how this worked with the open source things. I'm assuming that it fell under the aspect of they were selling you a little bit of support, right? You know, because of the box set, you could call them up and get at least some answers to your questions and things like that. And you were they were providing the software to you on the CDs, and it was duplication of the CDs, whatever their justification for it was. About $50 or so, you could buy a copy of this stuff. And eventually, and probably somewhere, maybe in the pile of CARP, it's an acronym, upstairs in the Mad Scientist Lab, there may still be a SUSE Linux, or SUSE Linux, however it is pronounced, I bought. It was probably an open package, because that was usually my want on some of these things. The Boston store especially had some great open package kinds of things where people bring stuff back into the store and you get a discount on it. And I attempted to install that on a Toshiba laptop that I had at the time. And I had the Toshiba laptop pretty well tricked out as much as you could. It had a removable CD bay, and I had a replaceable hard drive that I could slip into that bay, and also I could slip out the CD-ROM drive and put in a very useful little drive that would write to zip disks. These are the old 100 megabyte original zip disks, and that one stayed in there quite a bit. And so I had the Toshiba, but, you know, there were various and sundry things that were problematical. Getting dial-up to work and all that kind of thing was a little bit tricky based upon what kind of modem you had and whether it was a WIN modem, which good luck on that, or whether it was a real modem chip that was built into the machine and the sound and things like that. I basically, as I remember, got that machine to the point where I could get to a command line, but I was never going to get Xlindos to work on it. And, you know, I played around with it some, but, you know, didn't stick with it and got off onto another tangent or something like that. And I started actually carrying a secondary laptop that was not the work laptop to try doing my own stuff on it. This consisted of the extremely overpriced Sony Vaios, which I would never buy new because I couldn't afford those, but I would find reasonable buys for those used, and they were very, very thin. Didn't have a drive included. You'd have to have an external drive, but, you know, it was a viable solution. I wanted something as minimal in terms of weight. If I'm going to carry an extra laptop with me for my personal stuff, I wanted to be as minimal as possible. And I tried that out on the various Sonys and never quite got everything going to the point that, you know, yeah, I had a command line, but I really wasn't going to do the communications, and I wasn't going to get to a GUI, and I did play around with sound, was never working quite right with them and things, typical kinds of things at the time that would happen with laptops, and I wanted it to be something that was with me on the road, and so I made some attempts there at Linux along the way there in the 90s. But since I was running my desktop, none of them ever actually stuck. And I didn't really own a desktop machine that was PC compatible until the late 90s when I actually purchased one of those just to be able to branch off into that realm of things, and never did try to put anything on the beige box that was Linux related and things like that. So that takes me all the way through the 90s. pretty much just occasionally working with it, but never quite taken, and we didn't really have anything going on at work that was anything related to that. And eventually I got to the point where I had another laptop that was an IBM ThinkPad. I had ThinkPads for several years there from work, and it started getting into some situations where it was having problems with the hardware and things like that, and I rediscovered Linux in the form of Nopix, which will be the next iteration of this, but I think I probably rattled on here often enough. One last thing, though, on the technological side of things that you kind of forget about. Number one, I always liked 1200 baud because I could read that fast and comprehend and not ever have to scroll back or stop. 1200 baud was perfect for me. 2400 baud was just a little bit too fast in watching all the text go by from the BBS. But I could push myself at 2400. The interesting thing technologically that you have to remember pre this idea of having various concepts of getting high speed to your house. You know, most people, I had to wait for a few years, but most people have a choice of, if they live in an urban area, a cable modem, some kind of DSL kind of a solution, fiber if they're lucky, right? So there's various kinds of solutions. But back in the day, it was all about the dial-up. And I had AT&T dial-up that I settled on because they had lots of dial-up numbers all over the place where I was traveling to, and that's what I used for years and years and years. I bought one of the first, quote-unquote, modern pieces of equipment that I bought that was kind of the wave of the future from Apple, was one of the very first AirPorts. It looked like a flying saucer, about 4 inches in diameter, 5 inches in diameter for this disc, right? And it looked like a giant hockey puck or one of those things they use for curling, right? But it had this little angle thing that came out of it, and you would plug in your wires there. And that, of course, gave me Wi-Fi. And, of course, it had an Ethernet port on it, but the other thing it had on it was a modem was built in. And that's how I provided Wi-Fi to the first iBooks that had Wi-Fi capability. And the first Wi-Fi capability at our house was provided through AT&T dial-up from the very first model of the AirPort, dialing in to get to the internet connection and then sharing that over Wi-Fi 802.11b, of course, which was more than fast enough for how fast that that dial-up connection would go. Anyway, this is Mr. Gadgets kind of wandering through some of the technological issues along the way. And next time, we'll actually talk about when I really started using Nopix in earnest, fixing my laptop problems with it, and continuing on to use that as my dual boot solution of choice up until right now. We'll talk to you later. You be careful out here on the technological frontier, and I will be trailblazing ahead of you. Bye now.
Thank you for listening to Hacker Public Radio. For more information on the show and how to contribute your own shows, visit hackerpublicradio.org.